this lesson tonight will be the first in what you would call the last four scenes in the life of the Lord. Next Sunday evening, I want to speak to you on the subject, Behold the Man. And then the following Sunday evening, I want to speak to you on The Lord is Risen. And then the following, we'll conclude the study of John by the study of the 21st chapter of John and study the subject, the returning love. Tonight, however, we want to notice the expression, the hour has come. By this expression, Jesus meant that the zero hour was now there. He was talking about the hour of his death, the hour of his betrayal, I think, perhaps first, or his being turned over to the mob, and then his being turned over to the Sanhedrin, his trial, and, of course, his crucifixion. And three times in the 12th chapter of John, he uses the expression, the hour. The hour has come. And then as we read tonight, he asked the question, shall I ask the Father to save me from this hour? And then he said, no, for this reason I've come to this hour. In other words, that's why I'm here. That's why I was born, indicating that Jesus Christ was as good as dead the day he was born. That's why he came. And then he uses three other expressions, or one other expression, three times, and says the word now. Now is my soul troubled. Now is the judgment of this world. Now is the ruler, or shall the ruler of this world be cast out. And by the use of this word now, and by the use of the expression the hour, Jesus Christ shows that something was happening and the closing hours of his life were at hand. Jesus was referring, of course, to the countdown to the cross. However, as far as the Jews were concerned, I think the Jews had begun a serious countdown to the cross as early as a year earlier. In John, the 7th chapter, we've noticed as we studied that chapter, that was a year almost exactly between, a year earlier. John 7 and verse 1 says that Jesus refused to go about in Judea anymore because the Jews sought to kill him. That was stated perhaps around April of A.D. 28. And then we find later on in October of that year at the Feast of Pentecost, recorded in John the 8th chapter, verse 59, so they took up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. And then in the latter part of chapter 10, we find that the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Verse 39, again they tried to arrest him, but he escaped from their hands. That was in the month of December of that year, A.D. 28. And then in about February of 29, he came back to the city of Jerusalem and Bethany. He healed or raised Lazarus from the dead. And after the commotion that was caused by the raising of this man from the dead, it says from that hour or from that day on, they took counsel how to put him to death. And then in verse 57, now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him. And it was very aptly put, their policy was very aptly put into words by Caiaphas the high priest, who just simply said it is expedient for the nation that one die for all, for the people, and that the whole nation should not perish. And so we see this juggling of people, this juggling of lives, this expediency taking hold, and we find an exchange being made. One man for a whole nation. Well, that's a pretty good exchange. Caiaphas was high priest that year, and John says that Caiaphas, in saying this, prophesied. Well, that's what accounts for the statement being made when it was made. But what was the statement, or what was that that accounted for the whole transition, or the whole transaction, rather? What was it that accounted for the transaction whereby one man's life was taken in order for the whole nation to be saved? Well, we'll come to that later on in this 12th chapter of John. But there are some events leading up to that final hour that I think you'll be interested in. I think we'll throw some light on the subject. The last week of December in A.D. 28, Jesus left Jerusalem and went across the Jordan River to a place that John had used as a baptismal pool or pond, And I suppose it was nothing more, if at all, a small community or village, and maybe just a wilderness hideout. This is recorded in John the 10th chapter and verse 40, where Jesus went across the Jordan and stayed there with his disciples. And I suppose he would have stayed there until the time that he returned for the Passover, had it not been for the fact that shortly after he arrived in this location, he received a message from Mary and Martha that simply stated, "Lord, he whom you love is sick." Well, Jesus waited. He knew who they were talking about. They were talking about Lazarus. Jesus waited 2 days for his own reasons, and after 2 days he announced to his disciples that Lazarus had died and that it was necessary now for them to go up to the city of Bethany and to be with these people, their friends. Over the protests of his own disciples regarding the seriousness of the condition and how it had deteriorated to the point that it was actually now dangerous for him to be found in Judea, Jesus said, "It's still daylight, let's walk while it's daylight, and no one will hurt you." And so he said, "I'm going." Thomas showed here a very unusual strength of courage when he said, well, he told the other disciples, he said, "Come on, let's go with him. Let's go die with him if necessary." And he made his affirmation here of his confidence in Jesus that he was willing to die for him. But anyway, they left this place across the Jordan, crossed and probably came through Jericho, went to Bethany. They went there and found Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. And Jesus then, as you know the story in John the 11th chapter, Jesus raised this man from the dead. And it caused such a stir and a commotion among the Jews that they were willing now to put Lazarus to death. And Lazarus became then really the first projected martyr, the first martyr of those who were followers of Jesus. Whether they followed through with their plans, I don't know. But they were wanting to put Lazarus to death also. But after Jesus had raised Lazarus back to life, he didn't remain there in the Jerusalem area. He went on back northeast about 15 miles to a little village named Ephraim, which was just a little village tucked away there in near the wilderness, near the Jordan, and northeast from Jerusalem, northwest from Jericho. And he remained there, we're told, in John, about the 11th chapter. He remained there until about the 1st of April, and at which time he then left Ephraim again, came on to the city of Jericho, where he spent the day with Zacchaeus, and where he healed blind Bartimaeus and one of his friends who were outside the city waiting when the procession came by. They asked who it is and what all the commotion was, and somebody said, "It's Jesus of Nazareth." And blind Bartimaeus would not be hushed. He said, "Son of David, have mercy on me." They said, "Shh, get quiet." He said, "Get out of my way." And he threw his coat down when the Lord finally said, "Call him to me." He threw his cloak off and ran to Jesus, and Jesus healed him and the man that was with him. Well, he left then the city of Jericho probably on the Friday preceding his death on the following Friday. It was a week prior to his death on that following Friday. He left Jericho probably on that Friday, arrived in Bethany either Friday night or Saturday morning to find that some of his friends, Simon the leper for one, and Mary and Martha and Lazarus for three more at least that we know were there, and many other friends, and Simon had made a feast for him in his home. Now, John doesn't tell us whose home it was in, but I think it's Matthew. In Matthew, the 26th chapter, tells us that it was in the home of Simon the leper where this supper was given. And as you might expect, who was serving? Which one of the sisters, Mary or Martha, was serving? Well, Martha was serving. John says that here in John 12. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper. Martha served, and like men will, Lazarus was one of those at the table with him. And then, as is customary for Mary, Mary took a pound of costly ointment of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the ointment. Isn't that a beautiful description, an eyewitness description of a man who was there and smelled the fragrance of this beautiful nard that had been poured on the Lord? And here again, Mary is at the feet of Jesus. You remember that one of the other times when it said that Martha was serving and Mary was sitting at the feet of Jesus? Here she was again at the feet of Jesus. And this time she anointed them with this beautiful ointment. Well, the disciples were infuriated. They were just indignant over this waste. It seems that Judas was the spokesman, and he had been the one maybe that stirred up the trouble and said, "Why this waste? This might have been sold, and this might have been given then to the poor." Might is right. John said Judas said this not because he was interested in the poor. He said it because he was a thief, and that he had the bag, and he took the money out of the bag for his own personal use. John unmasks the hypocrite and says that's why he made this statement. But nevertheless, the reason why I bring this into this story tonight is that it was here that Jesus then announced his death and burial. Because when Mary had anointed the feet of Jesus and the fragrance of this nard filled the house, Jesus then, responding to the chiding and rebuke of his disciples, said to them, "Leave this woman alone. She's done a beautiful thing to me." And he said, "She has anointed me for my burial." And so here in front of his disciples, in front of these friends, Jesus Christ once more announced his burial, his death and his burial. And when you look at it from that point of view, this was the first of a whole series of references to his death that was made either, or that were made either to the people or the friends or the Jews. But nevertheless, this was the first of a whole series in this final countdown in this last week before the coming of his death. And yet, when you look at it from another point of view, this was only one of many that had been made down through the 3 years of his personal ministry. Because Jesus had lived always under the shadow of the cross. There was never a time when he was not definitely sure and was not certain why he had come. And when he asked here, "What shall I say?" he said, "My soul is troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour." He said, "No, for this reason I've come to this hour." You remember back as far back as when his personal ministry first began. We noticed it in John, the first chapter. You remember when Jesus was coming down the road toward John near the Jordan River, and John pointed to him and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." Well, he was referring to the death of Christ then. When Jesus then went into the temple a day or two later in Jerusalem and drove out the money changers and turned over the tables and drove out the oxen and the cattle and said, "Get out of here. You're not going to make my Father's house a den of thieves." They said, "By what authority are you doing this?" They said, "Show us a sign." Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Well, they thought he meant the temple that Herod had built, that it was at 46 years being built, but he meant his body. And this was a veiled reference to his being killed and that he would be raised after 3 days. They used this against him at his trial. So this was one of the things that Jesus had said that indicated that he knew full well what he was going to do and what was to be done to him. But other things, in some of the parables that he taught, Jesus let it be known that he was going to die. In one of the parables, the parable of the vineyard. You remember the story of the vineyard, how that Jesus said there was a man that bought a vineyard and he built it and put a tower up in it and put a hedge around about it and let it out to tenants. And then in the due season, he sent these servants of his to the tenants to receive the reward or to receive the income from the vineyard. And they killed some of them and they mistreated others and they shamed others. Finally, he said, "I'll send my own son. Surely they'll respect him." But you know the story. He said that when they saw the son coming, they said, "Look, here comes the heir. Let's kill him and then the inheritance will be ours." So in some of his parables even, Jesus inserted this thing of his death and let it be known from the very outset that he was destined to die. We find him using it also in some of his favorite sayings. Jesus had one favorite saying that he seems to have used over and over, and it was the saying, "The sign of Jonah." And I don't know why he chose and why he had such a liking to this particular sign, but it was more or less what you would call a type of the coming of the death of Christ. And Jesus utilized it and said, "Just as Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days and 3 nights, so shall the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth 3 days and 3 nights." So we find these expressions being given by Jesus and being used by him. And he discussed the thing very objectively. There was no real pressure on him. He seems to have been very objective. He seems to have been calm and cool and collected. In fact, about 18 months before he died, he began, however, to condition his disciples, and he taught them in detail about what was going to happen to him. But there's no indication of any pressure. He was still very objective, very calm. He just simply took them aside, even as early as Matthew, the 21st chapter, which is about 18 months at least before his death, perhaps 2 years. And then we find in Mark, the 10th chapter, a reference that did not come probably before, maybe 10 days or 2 weeks before his actual death. But on that occasion, he was still teaching them that he was going to have to go to the city of Jerusalem and be spit upon, he said, and scourged and condemned to death, and that he would be delivered to the Gentiles, and they would mock him and spit upon him and scourge him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. But you see, all these things, and it seems that not all of these, Jesus Christ was still very objective about it. He was not caught up in the emotion of the hour. And yet, if you'll watch closely, you'll begin to see the points of strain. You'll begin to see those hours when the strain began to show in the face or in the personality of Jesus. For example, in the book of Luke, I think it is, chapter 12, Jesus there said, "I have come to cast fire upon the earth." And he said, "How I wish that it was already kindled." And then again in Luke 12 and verse 50, he makes the statement, "I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how I am straitened or constrained until it be accomplished." And then there's a beautiful and strange passage in the book of Mark in chapter 10, where incidentally this was this trip from Ephraim on up through Jericho and on to Jerusalem. While they were on the road from Ephraim to Jericho, Jesus began to make another attempt to teach these disciples that he was going to be crucified. But it says they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed. And those who followed were afraid. I don't understand that. But I think maybe we can understand it. I don't know what it quite means here by them being amazed. But have you ever been involved in a crowd, or have you ever taken your children to a fair? And the little children, you know, grown-ups don't get all that excited about a fair. But the children do, and they're all out ahead, you know, all of them walking about at a 30-degree incline, wanting to get on down there to the fair and get their seats, and the thing's about to start, and they're wanting to be right there on the 50-yard line. I think that's what we have here. I think Jesus was so anxious to get this thing on the road, and he began now to feel the intensity of the pressure, and he was wanting to get on, and he was on out ahead of them, and it says that they were amazed. I guess maybe he had always walked with them. And I think that may be why they were amazed. But it says that those that followed along were afraid. And I think they sensed something in the air that they saw in Jesus that they had not seen before. They sensed a fear, an apprehension, and they were just a bit skittish over it and didn't quite know what to think about it. Well, it was this setting in which we find the statement made, "The hour has come." This, I think you might say, began a period of intense pressure. I think this period of intense pressure began and is recorded here in John the 12th chapter in verse 23. At least this is the first indication that we get of it. It was an intense period of pressure that lasted probably no longer than 42 hours. I believe that it lasted from Wednesday morning through Thursday midnight, at which time he was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. Let me show you why I believe that it was Wednesday, that this was the period really of Wednesday that we're talking about here in the text in John 12. You know, when you reconstruct the last week, the Passover week, if you take all four of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and try to restructure it or structure it to where you can get an idea of what the schedule of events was, you'll come to these conclusions, and they're very clearly outlined in the Gospels. Saturday, before his death the following Friday, Saturday was this feast in the home of Simon the leper. That was on Saturday. On Sunday, we find, John says, the next day was this triumphal entry into Jerusalem. That night, one of the synoptics records that Jesus Christ went into the temple and then looked around, and then the next day went back and cleaned out the temple the next morning and did something similar to what John records in John 2. And that on Monday then was the cleansing of the temple. Saturday was the feast in Simon the leper's house. Sunday was the triumphal entry. Monday was the cleansing of the temple. Tuesday was spent, it seems, entirely teaching in the temple, trying to make one last effort to bring the Jews a fuller knowledge of what he had come to do. And he told so many parables in Matthew, the 21st chapter, 22nd chapter, and 23rd. You have the parables of the five foolish virgins and the five wise virgins. You have the parable of the king making the marriage feast for his son. And so many parables that he taught them on that one day, Tuesday, recorded in Matthew 21, 22, and 23. Then, toward the close of the day, he took his disciples and they went out to the Mount of Olives. They sat down after they went over the brook Kidron and went up into the Mount of Olives. They sat down up there overlooking the city. And you can see the entire city of Jerusalem by sitting down on that Mount of Olives. And that's where he taught his disciples about the coming of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. That was on Tuesday evening. They went on back, it seems, every night. They would go back out to Bethany where they were staying. And accommodations were hard to come by at this time because thousands upon thousands of people crowded into the city of Jerusalem at this particular time. And Jesus had reservations out at Bethany, and he went back out there every night and spent the night. The next day was Wednesday, and I've always been undecided about what the things were that transpired on Wednesday. I never have been able to determine it. On Thursday, we know that that was the day of preparation for the Passover. And we find in Luke, the 22, we find Jesus sending, I think it was Peter and James, but sending them into the city to make preparation. That took place on Thursday morning, and they went in there and had their sheep inspected, had it slaughtered. They prepared it and prepared for the feast. Then after sundown, Jesus and his disciples ate the supper in that upper room. That was Thursday. And then, of course, that night, about midnight, the mob came to the Garden of Gethsemane. They arrested the Lord, took him into the Sanhedrin, tried him, took him to Herod, took him to Pilate. Now, these were three of the locations of his trials. And then, of course, he was standing before Pilate at 6 o'clock on Friday morning. By noon, he was on the cross. By 5 that afternoon, he was dead and was removed by Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus and was buried. But Wednesday had always eluded me. I couldn't figure out what the events were. I am thoroughly convinced, I may be wrong, but I've concluded that Wednesday was occupied with these events that we read about here in the 12th chapter of John, beginning in verse 20 and going through verse 50. And here they were. They show a particular aspect of the Lord that we never have seen before. I think that Wednesday's schedule is recorded in this that we're using as tonight's text. And when you look at the fact that he had finished all of his teaching with the Jews, and he had spent Tuesday teaching them in detail. He had wrapped up more or less his teaching with the Jewish people, and he had nothing more really to say to them. Now, he spent Thursday night talking to his disciples in John 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. 5 chapters contained the information and the dialogue between Jesus and his disciples there on that Thursday night. But Wednesday was taken up with this time that he began to turn then to himself and think about the coming death, his impending crucifixion. And friends, it was so overwhelming that Jesus, well, he nearly broke under it. Let me give you an illustration of what I mean. There are 3 things that happen that makes me say that the door of access to Jesus just gently closed. Do you know what that means? Never before in our knowledge of the Lord had the door of access ever closed to people. Never. But you watch what happens here. Number one, the door of access closed to people. They couldn't get to him. Some Greeks came up, and in about verse 20, these Greeks came up to Philip and said, "Sir, we would see Jesus." Philip went to Andrew and said, "These men want to see Jesus." Then Philip and Andrew went to Jesus and said, "Lord, there's some men that want to see you." But listen to Jesus' answer. And Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And you almost expect Philip and Andrew to touch him on the shoulder and say, "Lord, did you hear us? There's some men here that want to see you." They didn't, I don't guess. But the answer that Jesus gave was no more related to the question that they asked than anything. It just wasn't related. And if you'll notice what follows in the next few verses here that our brother read tonight, it is so unrelated to what's going on round about him that you almost would say that Jesus here was incoherent. I want you to notice, he says 7 things here about his death. Not a single one of them was related to any of the questions they were asking him. Not a one. Philip and Andrew said, "There's some men here that want to see you." And that touched him off, and he said, "Now the hour has come. The Son of Man is to be glorified." Number 2, he starts talking about grains of wheat falling into the ground and dying. "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." And then he says something that he had no doubt told his disciples. In fact, we know he had told them before. He had said before that if any man would come after me, let him deny himself. And then what shall a man be profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? But listen to this statement here. And it seems as though he's not stating this for his disciples. It seems as though he was stating it for his own encouragement. that he had said this so many times to others, now he was the one that was under real pressure and tension. And he says, he who loves his life loses it. He who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. And then a fourth thing, he says, if anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there shall my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. The fifth thing he said was this, now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, for this purpose I have come to this hour. The sixth thing was this, now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the ruler of this world be cast out. And the seventh thing, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. And John says he said this to show by what death he was to die. You see these seven things that he mentions? One question was asked him, and in the middle of these seven things, there was only one thing that interrupted him, and that was when he said, Father, glorify my name, and there was a thundering. The multitude said there was a thundering. Others speculated that an angel had spoken to him, but Jesus knew in the audible tone or the understandable language was simply this, that I have glorified it. His own Father bore witness to him and said, I have glorified it, and I'm going to glorify it again shortly. I will glorify it again. But that was the one thing that interrupted these seven sayings regarding his death. And he just simply said these things, and he could not be jarred away from them. And I just simply say that there was no other, there was nothing that people could do to bring his attention around to the circumstances of the hour, of any hour except the one that he was so involved with. And people just couldn't get to him. It was too late. It was too late. But a second thing that we get the impression about the stress of this hour was the fact that it was too late for questions. Some of the people standing around said to him, we've heard from the law that the Christ abides forever. After Jesus said, the Son of Man must be delivered up when I am delivered up, or when I'm lifted up, they said, we've heard from the law that the Christ abides forever. How do you say then that the Son of Man must be lifted up? And who is this Son of Man? But he didn't even answer them. He just simply said, a little while longer you have the light among you. While you have it, walk in it, lest the darkness overtake you. And that's all he said. I've never known a time in the life of the Lord when a question did not arouse him. I've never found a place in the Gospels where a good debate didn't arouse the Lord. But we're faced with one here. They posed him three questions. We've heard in the law that the Christ abides forever. How do you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? And who is this Son of Man? But he just simply said, it's not going to be here much longer. You better rejoice in it while it's here. You better walk in this light while it's here, because shortly the darkness will overtake you. And then a third thing that is said here that indicates the great pressure that he was under. It says he went away and hid. Verse 36, he went away and hid. Of course, it was said on other occasions that he went off and hid from the people. But that was because his hour had not yet come. This says that his hour had come, and he still went and hid. I think it indicates the Lord's extremity. I think that this was the point, probably, where he more nearly touches my weakness, and where we more nearly identify with the Lord Jesus Christ than perhaps at any other point in his life. Have you ever wanted to go away and hide and get away from the responsibilities of life? Well, you know how the Lord felt here. He went off and hid. When I first discovered this about 6 years ago, I nearly wept. I was almost speechless. I never had found that the Lord was that near to breaking, but he was. These three things, I think, indicate that this period from Wednesday morning through, well, I think Wednesday, the day of Wednesday, during the daylight hours, was this conversation that the Lord almost had with himself about his death. People couldn't get to him. Questions were no longer in order, and he went off and hid. Shortly after that, it seems he regained his composure. He stood up and says, and he cried out and said, and he gave one last warning and one last invitation, as though he would say, I'll not leave you until I can give you one more warning and give you one more invitation. He who believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. And he who sees me sees him who sent me. I have come as light into the world, that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness. If anyone hears my sayings and does not keep them, I don't judge him. For I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. He who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has a judge. The word that I have spoken will be his judge on the last day. For I have not spoken on my own authority. The Father who sent me has himself given me commandment what to say and what to speak. And I know that his commandment is eternal life. What I say, therefore, I say as the Father has bidden me. And that's the last exhortation that Jesus gave to the Jewish people. John more or less signs off this whole episode of the battle between Jesus and the Jews. And this is what he says precipitated the hour of the Lord's death. Though he had done so many signs before them, this is verse 37, though he had done so many signs before them, yet they didn't believe in him. It was that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. And then he quotes from that beautiful mountain peak of prophecy, Isaiah 53, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe, John says, for Isaiah said again, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes and perceive with their heart and turn for me to heal them. But this was all of prophecy, but I want to ask you, what was it? What is it? What incident or what factor in the lives of these people caused the prophecies to be fulfilled? And what was it that precipitated the coming of this hour of the Lord, where he was substituted and his death was put in the place of the nation of the Jews? What was this that was in the minds of these people that caused it to be brought about? And here it is. Nevertheless, even many of the authorities believed in him. But for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, for fear of being put out of the synagogue. For they loved the praise of men more than they love the praise of God. And that's what precipitated the hour of the Lord. Young people, I would say that without any question, the one thing that is the greatest temptation in your life will be this temptation that you see here that caused the hour of the Lord to be brought on. And that was, men love to be liked. Men love the honor of men more than they love the honor of God. Peer pressure, group pressure. When you fail the Lord and when you again crucify him, as we many times do, we deny him, you know what causes it? I would say that 90 times out of 100 it will be brought about because peer pressure is so strong on you. Group pressure, to be like the ones that are around about you, to the point that you just simply don't have the strength of conviction to stand up and let your vote be counted for the Lord. These men, these rulers of the Jews, turned their back upon the Son of God and missed the chance that a bare handful of people out of all the multiplied millions on the face of the earth from Adam until this present hour have had at their disposal had they only taken advantage of it. Here was the Son of the living God right there in the front of them. But they wouldn't confess it because they were afraid of what the people round about them would say. Oh, I would beg you, think about this man. He's the most amazing character I've ever read of. He indeed must be the Son of God. He's so great. I never tire of thinking about him. I never tire of preaching of him. I have to just whip myself to get out of sight of his life and to get into other areas that I know you need. Let's not be guilty of precipitating again the hour of the Lord's crucifixion by falling into the same trap that these people did that brought his death on initially, loving the glory of men more than the glory of God. Do you love the Lord? Do you want his glory? Do you want his honor and his good? Don't let other people persuade you to do otherwise. Stand up for Jesus and let your vote be counted.